So, why did I, Trevor Noah, decide to do a podcast? I think this podcast gives me an opportunity to have the conversations that I've been having just with other people able to listen in on them. Come to this podcast because you want to think. Come to this podcast because you want to have fun. Come to this podcast because you want to be challenged. Listen to What Now with Trevor Noah every Thursday on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, hey, from Chicago, man. I'm like three blocks from our old office. I'm like looking out at the Shrump Hotel here on Wacker.
Oh, yeah. I go back there every now and then, and I'm so nostalgic that I eat in that like dingy basement of 233 North Michigan at like the burrito place I used to go to. It's still there.
What was our restaurant, Houlihan's, where we got the chicken fingers and beers?
Houlihan's was the spot. Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no Houlihan's anymore.
Yeah. What happened to Houlihan's?
Yeah.
But Chicago's looking good. It's beautiful out here. It's a lot of fired up Democrats. I think our hotel is full of like the Nebraska delegation. So there's just endless political chatter as you get on and off the elevator, which, you know.
I mean, they got to deliver that one electoral vote, you know.
We need that congressional district. But we got a lot for you guys today. So we're going to talk about foreign policy or the lack thereof at the Democratic convention this year. We're going to talk about some of the Gaza protests happening outside of the convention in Chicago. And then obviously the latest on the ceasefire talks in Israel itself. We're also going to talk about how the Ukrainian military offensive into Russia has changed the war, and then another major leadership change in Thailand. And then we'll talk a little bit about Elon Musk's new superfan in Chechnya. Lucky him. He's got another car enthusiast there.
Yeah.
And then, Ben, I think you did our interview today. What are folks going
to
hear?
Yeah, Tommy, I talked to Asu Komarcheva, who is the journalist for Radio Free Europe, who was part of that massive prisoner exchange that just went down. Another reporter unjustly detained, imprisoned inside of Russia. So we talk about her experience, what that was like, how she feels being a part of that exchange, what her life is like now. So it's a fascinating peek behind the curtain. We heard this story from Jake Sullivan a couple weeks ago. Now we hear from the other side of it, of what it was like to be inside of a Russian prison in that exchange. So people should definitely check that out.
That's amazing. Also, we heard about it from Joe Biden last night. I mean, this was sort of a big focal point of his speech with some of these hostage negotiations. So he clearly sees this as like one of the most important things he's done in his political career.
Yeah, it's clearly something they take a lot of pride in. And as Jake mentioned, you know, the last call he had to make to the Slovenians, they're the ones who had to release those, you know, Russian illegals, was literally like a couple hours before he made his statement dropping out of the race. So I think it's all kind of connected psychologically. At this incredibly difficult time in his presidency, they were also doing this very difficult piece of business. So a lot of understandable pride in that.
Yeah, in that juggling that he did in this horrible moment for him personally or for his presidency is such an interesting window into the presidency generally. I mean, you know, the famous example for us in the Obama administration was Obama authorizing the operation to kill Osama bin Laden while editing his comedy speech.
Yeah. It's just Trump roast at the correspondence dinner.
At the correspondence dinner, yeah. So this is a little different, but it gives you a window into how weird the job is. All right, so let's talk about the convention for a bit, Ben, because, you know, over the years, there have been a lot of conventions with a huge focus on foreign policy or national security. 1968 is the one everyone was talking about coming into this convention because both were in Chicago. But that year, the DNC was marred by these huge anti-war protests and a fight over ending the war in Vietnam. I say that because the cops beat the shit out of the protesters, not because I disagreed with the protesters. There were some people who were worried that those scenes might repeat themselves this year. But as of Tuesday afternoon, that's not really been the case. There have been some protests, but nothing like 68, but more on that in a bit. But again, you know, even later, like the 2004 Republican and Democratic conventions focused a ton of time on terrorism, on 9/11, on the war in Iraq. Even in 2008, there was a fight over Iraq. It was like front and center. Obviously, it was Obama talking about ending the war. And then in 2016, there was a fight over the Trans-Pacific Partnership or TPP trade deal. How's that for a deep cut, Ben?
Deep cut, man. You know, you're really tugging on my heartstrings, Tommy.
I knew I'd get you with that one. But this year, I mean, look, there's just like very little Worldo content in the daily convention themes and even in the speeches. President Biden did talk about his foreign policy record last night. Here's a sampling of some of what he said.
I'm going to say something outrageous. I know more foreign leaders by their first names and know them well than anybody alive. Just because I'm so damn old. When Trump left office, Europe and NATO was in tatters. Not a joke. America First doctrine changed our whole image in the world. Putin thought he'd take Kyiv in 3 days. 3 years later, Ukraine is still free. When I came to office, the conventional wisdom was that China would inevitably surpass the United States. They haven't noticed. No one's saying that now. To end the civilian suffering of the Palestinian people and finally deliver a ceasefire and end this war. Those protesters out in the street, they have a point. A lot of innocent people are being killed on both sides.
So, you know, Ben, let's get to the Gaza protests and portion of this in a minute. But I'm just curious what you thought of the speech. And also, I mean, I guess there's sort of a meta question of what Joe Biden's decision to step down, even when he could have run again, sends to the world, especially at a time when you've got these like old decrepit leaders, you know, clinging to power, changing the Constitution to stay in longer, and just doing everything they can to put themselves ahead of the interests of their own countries.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell in those clips, you know, he takes a lot of pride in his kind of foreign policy record. I thought the speech in general was, you know, much heavier on like his accomplishments than Kamala Harris's campaign.
Yeah, a lot of accomplishments.
Which, you know, he was entitled to, kind of earned the gold watch night on night one, you know. And look, I think you hear in his litany there, you and I are all here for the world of content. But, you know, one of the things, Tommy, I mean, I'm going to swerve here, that I thought was troubling in that interregnum, you know, between the debate and when he made the decision, is that he was often pivoting to foreign policy, right? So remember, obviously, that NATO press conference or the interview with George Stephanopoulos when he was like, you know, I'm the guy who did the Pacific Basin. And actually, like, it felt not meeting people where they were. You know, like, that's usually not the first concern on people's minds is, you know, NATO expansion and the Pacific Basin. And so in some ways, the shift to a more kind of economic message heavy convention, it feels like part of what is going right for Democrats, you know?
Definitely.
And I say that as someone who cares a lot and does believe that, you know, leaders need to kind of hit these boxes. And, you know, I think what he was trying to get at with the China piece was probably the more powerful argument that I hope Kamala can pull together and I think Obama can pull together tonight, which is all of these things from the investments being made at home to what she wants to do to continue to lower costs to, you know, rejuvenating our foreign policy, they're actually kind of part of America being able to compete and kind of win in the 21st century, you know? So there is a way to thread these things together, you know, standing up for the right things at home and abroad, getting America ready to compete, standing up to autocracy. The trick is to tie the democracy message at home to what we're doing abroad. This is all part of one global fight, and America should be on the right side of that. Trump's on the wrong side, you know? And, you know, I think that rather than it feeling like a list, it's how do you kind of tie this together so it all makes sense for people that somehow, you know, what's happening in Ukraine is kind of connected to what's happening here. I do think, Tommy, that there's a huge opportunity in our election, you know, to your last question there. You know, I'd written this kind of dark piece about the rise of fascism and all the autocrats. But now there's a whole way in which this year of elections, if Kamala can pull this off and kind of really put Trump in the rearview mirror, because, you know, that will be 4 out of 5 elections for Democrats. I don't think Trump is going to run again. It could be the kind of decisive moment in this year of elections. It says, OK, there have been a lot of autocrats hanging on. But, you know, Modi took a hit in his election. The French faced down the far right in their election. You know, Bangladesh had an election that was stolen and then they tossed the person out. I actually do think we might be at an inflection point for good. And it feels weird. We've been doing this podcast for 7 years. I've never said that before, you know, but that's how much I think she, by representing this generational change, is a huge opportunity. Her winning is far more important than any foreign policy in terms of breaking the momentum of like a Putin, you know?
Yeah. And you know, look, I agree with you. Like, and we said this on Pod Save America. I won't repeat myself. I agree. He deserved his night. Like he wanted to do a stump speech on the accomplishments. He feels deeply that he didn't get enough credit for that. I did think that, you're right. Like, he bucked this global trend. He did this extraordinary thing. You had people comparing him to George Washington for like willingly giving up power when he didn't need to. And you could have made that like the centerpiece of this really unique speech and moment in our political history, but they just kind of went a different direction. And I don't know. I was excited for what it could have been. I'm not trying to be critical or nitpicky, but it was what it was. And also, people probably noticed that it started really, really late. Ben and I are on lots of text chains with speechwriters and communications people at the DNC who are desperately trying to cut down remarks by members of Congress and elected officials who just refuse in the most selfish way possible, just like will not trim their sails, will not give up their moment, will not make their speeches enough about Kamala Harris. And just know that a lot of people are as frustrated as you are, viewers.
Yeah. Well, and your point, I mean, look, Biden made the right decision. It was a heroic decision. It is totally unusual. You can tell that it's not sitting that well with him, you know, because even the line that he used, which is, you know, I love my country more than I love this job, was the same line that he used in the Oval Office address. You know, he almost doesn't want to spend time on it. But like the optic of the passing of the torch is embedded in the convention schedule, you know, and the vibes are going to just build and build and build till Kamala speaks on Thursday. And let's just say, you know, by the time people heard the Obamas, I have very high expectations for those speeches. I'm comfortable raising expectations for the Obama portion of the convention.
I love it. So, you know, of course, outside the arena, the war in Gaza was a huge focus. There were thousands of protesters taken to the streets. Here's actually a clip of one of them speaking.
If the Democrats want us to get out the vote for them, they need to actually earn our votes by giving us a meaningful change on Gaza. They have not done that. We are not going to do the work for them of getting Kamala Harris elected if they cannot stop the most basic thing, which is the slaughter of our people abroad with our money. So for Palestinian Americans, this is a fundamental issue. And we have spent 10 months watching our people die every day. To ask us to simply come out and just wait and hope that some change will happen before the election, it's just offensive, and it's completely insensitive to where we are as a community.
So that was from an interview done by Democracy Now, a protester they spoke to outside the venue. So far, the protests have been less of a disruptive factor, I think, that a lot of Democrats feared. Some protesters, I think, did delay some of the delegates from getting into the event for about 20 minutes, which held things up a bit. But it was a minor inconvenience compared to what people were talking about in 1968. There was also a Gaza protester who held up a banner during Biden's speech, but I didn't really disrupt anything. That doesn't mean that activists have given up or aren't trying to push the party to stop the war. They are doing these protests. There are panels on the treatment of the Palestinian people. There are press events with doctors and humanitarian workers. I actually ran into some of those activists yesterday. They were with Waleed Shaheed, Ben, who we both know, who's been doing a lot of great work, kind of helping them and get coverage. And I ended up talking with this a woman, a doctor, who had recently been inside Gaza delivering care. And it was like this just weird moment. Because I don't know, I felt for them. They seemed exhausted and frankly, like a little defeated because you have this giant venue full of Democrats who are fired up to beat Trump. They are fired up to vote for Kamala Harris. There's a lot of people there who are probably upset about Gaza, but they blame Biden and they think the most important near-term policy or priority that is defeating Trump because he would make things worse. And they're not, you know, going to penalize Harris for the current mess as much as they might have if it was still Biden. So the Democrats are less focused on Gaza, it feels like, than they were a few months ago. But if you're somebody who has lost loved ones in Gaza, or if you are someone who has family there, or if you were just like pained by what you read, I'm sure that vibe that feels so good or the lack of focus feels really hard for you and could feel really crass and gross. One bright spot for those activists is there was a like convention adjacent event, like a series of talks from Politico and CNN, where Michigan Senator Gary Peters called on Vice President Harris to break with President Biden on Gaza policy. Let's give a quick listen.
Do you think it's important that Vice President Harris show that there are some differences or at least distinctions between her policy when it comes to the Middle East and Gaza with President Biden?
Well, it shows that she's her own person. She thinks her own way.
She ought to do that, you think?
Yes, she is going to be our next president. And she has to start telling folks this is where she comes from, what she believes in, That's going to be natural. So there's going to be things that she agrees. There's going to be things you don't agree.
And when it comes to Michigan, though, you think it's important for her to show that distinction on her views toward Gaza with President Biden?
Yeah, if she has those views, she has to be clear about whatever those views are. She'll have to make.
Doesn't she?
Yeah, if she, and I think she has differences, and she'll talk about it. Back to authenticity. Be who you are.
Yeah.
Be what's in your gut. Tell us what motivates you. What drives you. People want to see that.
Will you convey to her at some point in the next couple of weeks that she ought to do that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. If I have a chance to, yeah.
I'm sure you will.
So that was Michigan Senator Gary Peters talking to Jonathan Martin from Politico. I don't know Ben, I bet a lot of our listeners don't know who Gary Peters is. He's not some like lefty liberal, but it was interesting that he was pretty publicly advocating for her to change course. I mean, that is a little bit of a bright spot to me.
Yeah. And Gary Peters, I dealt with every Democratic senator in the Iran deal fight. And he was one of the last votes that we got.
Oh, interesting.
Point being is he's not like some, you know, progressive on Israel issues. He's actually usually been very conventional. It did sound like one of those interviews where he wasn't sure he was making news as much as he was, you know?
I know. Jonathan was like poking him, make news, yeah. Make news.
He's poking him. He's like, no, I'm just saying she should tell people what she thinks. But look, you summed it up well. I mean, there is something depressing, Tommy, about the fact that, look, we've been covering Gaza every week on this show, but it kind of feels like since the attention shifted from the war itself to the campus protests and since the Biden administration withheld that one shipment, but then kind of went forward with the, you know, essentially hug Bibi approach, that there is this kind of deflation of attention on Gaza. At precisely the same time that there's been a hyper-focus, understandably, on the U.S. election with this transition to Kamala. And I'm sure that that can make people feel like people care less about this issue, but it's still very much there. It's still very much present. I thought that in the Biden speech, it was interesting that even Biden himself, like, you know, for him to say the protesters have a point, even he seemed to kind of want to go out of his way.
Yeah, he swerved to it.
To signal that he understood the opposition he's facing. So it's in people's heads. I think the important point for activists, though, is to kind of keep people focused on the policy, keep people focused on what's happening to the Palestinian people. I think Gary Peters put it well. Like, she can tell people what's going to motivate her, like what's going to be on her mind when she makes policy on these issues. And I think another thing is that the hyper-focus on the ceasefire itself,
yeah,
which is literally Lucy with the football. Every time, you know, they announce that it's about to happen, you know, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, more on that in a second.
It takes away from the fact that there's a lot, if she's elected, yes, there's ending the war, but there's also like, how is Gaza going to be rebuilt? Who's going to be the leadership of the Palestinians?
Yep.
Like, what's going to be the plan for a two-state solution? There are going to be issues in play, like should the U.S. pursue recognition unilaterally instead of negotiated? All these issues where I think, you know, she may not want to lay out a 10-point plan on all of them, but she's going to have to fill in some of the gaps in a debate, in Q&A. And I hope that the signal that she's giving is that she's going to make policy from a position of caring as much about the security and safety and dignity of a Palestinian child as an Israeli child, that there's an equality of how much lives matter. There's an equality of interest on both sides. And that's a kind of tone that has not been, I think, that present from the Biden administration. And so she can make that shift and begin to make that turn. You know, whatever she says about Gaza in her convention speech is going to be heavily scrutinized and will be one important signal in kind of a series of communications between now and the election, where I think she can give people a sense of where she's going. And let's be honest here, like, part of the reason there's less energy is that a lot of it was tied to Biden.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the frustration with the policy was about him. And now that he's not the nominee anymore, it's kind of natural that there'd be a diminution of intensity. But it doesn't mean that people are taking their eye off the ball here.
Yeah. And like, you know, you might even normally see a fight over the policy platform at the convention, but that was all locked basically when Biden was the nominee. So that didn't really happen this year. You know, like, there are other things that they could be talking about. I mean, Peter Beinart had a great piece in the New York Times where he was like, look, all Kamala Harris needs to do is say that she's going to follow current U.S. law.
Yes.
Specifically one called the Leahy Law that prohibits the United States from providing any assistance to units in an army or security force that commits gross human rights violations. It's never been applied to Israel. You could say it does now. That's one solution. I mean, my only advice to the activists is, you know, there was some reporting and one of the reports talked about how the protests weren't that big and there was this sort of leftover pile of signs on the ground. Some of them said Genocide Joe and Killer Kamala. And like, guys, I hear you. I love you. I'm with you. But if you're going to come to a Democratic convention and bring Killer Kamala and Genocide Joe signs, that is not going to help you build the big inclusive coalition you need to move people and like change minds within the Democratic Party and get them to change course. You know what I mean? It's just sort of like, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just telling you what's effective and what is not. And that's not going to be effective here.
Yeah. And I think there's a chance too to like, you know, she's the most important audience, but Congress is an audience too. I mean, you got to think strategically about changing the politics of this issue writ large. And I think you should see Kamala and her ascension as an opportunity, you know?
Yep.
I think Joe Biden would have been better than Donald Trump in the Middle East, but I get why some people would say, not really, actually, because he had a strategy of hugging Bibi, essentially. Well, we have a chance now for something different, you know? So embrace that chance rather than kind of try to make it almost like a fait accompli that she's going to be, you know, quote unquote, Killer Kamala. Let's give her a chance to be something different, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two forts of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there. Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two forts of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
So let's talk about the talks. So Secretary of State Tony Blinken was in Israel again over the weekend. It was his ninth trip to the Middle East since this war started. This visit comes as we're all still waiting for a potential retaliatory strike on Israel by Iran or Hezbollah or both in response to last month's assassination of Hezbollah and Hamas leaders. Last week, President Biden said a ceasefire deal is closer than we have ever been. He's sort of been overly optimistic like that before, including like months ago before Ramadan. But Tony Blinken sounded similarly optimistic. There were reports been of some sort of bridging proposal that might have finally brought the two sides together and given them something to agree on. But so far, still no deal. At the same time, though, there are lots of reports that Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has been adding new demands to the deal terms that have made these negotiations harder, including having Israeli forces control the border area between Egypt and Gaza, known as the Philadelphia Corridor, or as well as maintaining a buffer zone between northern and southern Gaza, where Bibi wants some process in place to screen people to prevent weapons from being smuggled to the north. We're starting to see, though, like reports pointing the finger at Netanyahu for these talks failing, and Bibi's own negotiators saying to the press that he is making things harder to get a deal because he refuses to give them any real flexibility. And by the way, these negotiators are not like squishy diplomats. It's the heads of the Mossad.
Yeah.
And the Shin Bet, who are the, you know, the CIA and FBI equivalents, and then a senior general. So these are like some hard-headed people. Ben, you and I have talked a lot of times about how obvious it is that Netanyahu is making it harder to get a deal. We can't say for sure if he's purposefully trying to prevent an agreement from happening, but it often sure feels that way. The U.S. coverage is slowly wising up to the fact, to that fact. I think the Israeli coverage has been there for a while, but it's still pretty skewed in the U.S. because you end up having the U.S. and Israel coordinate their statements blaming Hamas when things don't work out. And I'm not saying that like Hamas is a good faith actor, but they don't really get the same hearing from the media. But, you know, one final factor, Ben, that I just wanted to throw out there, there's been some reports that Trump may have called Netanyahu and told him not to cut a deal. Now, Trump was asked about this the other day. He denied it, but he is a pathological liar. You can imagine it happening, right? Like it doesn't have to be hey, BB, you know, don't give Biden a win. It could be like, hey, BB, just hold out. I'll get you a better deal. I don't know. What do you make of these like reports kind of slipping out and the potential role that Trump could be playing here?
Look, I mean, first of all, on the substance of it, there's always been this gap, which is that Hamas wants a ceasefire to end the war. And BB wants to say, sure, we'll get the hostages back and maybe there'll be a 6-week ceasefire, but then we're going to keep fighting the war. That's the fundamental gap. I think these other things are not small things, though. Like there's a lack of freedom of movement for Palestinians to return to their homes. The Israelis control the border crossings. It is a moving of the goalposts here. But it comes down to this core question of like, is this ceasefire about trying to end the war or not? You know, and Bibi has not been willing to get there. You know, a lot of the messaging seems designed to kind of blame Hamas, which, sure, I mean, like Hamas, bad actors here. But the question is, do you think the war needs to come to an end or not? And Bibi's clearly not there. I think with Trump, the irony of this whole thing is that Bibi already knows the American politics. You know, like,
I know
there's very few people that know American politics and Republican politics better than Bibi Netanyahu. And he's always known that prolonging the war helps keep him in power in Israel and probably helps Donald Trump on balance because it makes Joe Biden look weak because he can't, you know, bring about a ceasefire. So I'm just surprised that Trump is dumb enough to say out loud what is probably just the understanding that is implicit between him and Bibi. I would entirely expect him to do that. Look, when we were in the White House in 2016, in the transition period in December, Trump actively lobbied against a UN Security Council resolution criticizing Israel that the U.S. abstained from.
Right, yeah.
I mean, the Logan Act, you know, for those aficionados who know it, you're not supposed to work against the foreign policy of the United States. They loved to, like, throw up charges that John Kerry was violating the Logan Act because he, like, met with foreigners while Trump was president. This is about as blatant an undermining of U.S. foreign policies as possible, but nobody expects Trump to abide by any norms whatsoever. I think the thing is it should just be called out and named because you're right. There's this kind of presumption that the Biden administration has fed that the Israeli government have been good faith actors in these negotiations when I'm sure that the people from the Mossad and Shin Bet at the table with Tony Blinken and Bill Burns have probably been good faith actors, but Bibi, the political leadership, has not been. And that's just the reality that this is existing within.
Yeah, and it's just worth pointing out that, like, you have the head of the Mossad, the Shin Bet, senior generals saying that Bibi's not giving them enough flexibility in these talks. You have Gallant, the defense minister, saying that, you know what, we can actually manage the risk of pulling our troops off of the border between Egypt and Gaza. And hey, by the way, like figuring out a process to prevent smuggling will take months and we should not do that because it will delay a hostage deal that will get people home and they may die otherwise, right? So like the entire national security leadership of the professional class want a deal. It's like the ideologue politicians who do not. But like, meanwhile, everything's getting worse. I mean, there was a suicide bombing, Tel Aviv. A group called Islamic Jihad claim responsibility. Luckily, it sounds like it could have been a lot worse if this guy detonated his bomb in a more populated area. But that's the first suicide attack in Israel since 2016. Also over the weekend, Israeli strikes killed almost 30 people in Gaza. And then, you know, there's this public health crisis in Gaza that's just spiraling. You've got confirmed cases of polio there, the first time in 25 years. And the UN is trying to launch this vaccination campaign to stop it, but they can't do that in a war zone. So like the status quo is just going to get exponentially worse.
Yeah, this is going to be like the front of the agenda for Kamala Harris if she wins, no matter what happens. And I think part of what you see from Gallant and the military leadership is that they don't see much utility in continuing this war. You know, they're not going to destroy Hamas. By the way, like October 7th can't happen again. Like we've talked about this before, but October 7th, the IDF wasn't even on the border. So there's not like some risk of some mass Hamas invasion if they stop, you know, bombing schools in Gaza. This is about getting the hostages home, frankly, because they still don't have a plan for Gaza the day after and who's going to administer it. There's this kind of open-ended commitment from Bibi to control the territory. So the question is, do you just try to do something to get the hostages out diplomatically or not? And that's what Bibi's standing in the way of.
Yeah, just saving these people's lives.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sure we'll talk much more about this next week, but let's turn to Russia and Ukraine because Last week, we talked about the surprise Ukrainian military operation into Russian territory that resulted in Ukrainian forces now holding an estimated 400 square miles of Russian territory. So pretty significant incursion. Ukraine says they have since taken out or damaged three important bridges that are these key transportation routes from Russia to the Kursk region, which is where these Ukrainian troops went into. This could leave Russian troops encircled between the border and Ukrainian forces. So precarious situation for them. Zelensky is calling this a defensive operation and said in an address that his goal is to create a buffer zone on the aggressor's territory. Putin still hasn't really responded to the incursion in a major way. But on the Ukrainian front, Russian troops are advancing toward the Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk. Officials have started evacuating families. And if this city does fall under Russian control, it would be the largest population center since Bakhmut to fall to Russian forces. So the Russians are just chipping away on the main front. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reported that there were supposed to be secret talks in Qatar this month between Russian and Ukrainian officials to discuss making an agreement, sort of like a hybrid peace deal that said power and energy infrastructure would no longer be targeted. Apparently, these talks are now off after Ukraine's incursion into Russian territory. Bigger picture, Ukrainian officials are very concerned about the targeting of civilian energy infrastructure and the impact of hours and hours of daily power outages on the Ukrainian people and on the Ukrainian economy during the winter in particular. So that's a very important thing to watch. Ben, I'm curious what you made of these peace talks getting delayed. Like, on the one hand, I read the headline and I was like, oh no, that sucks. Like, I want there to be a constant dialogue about ending this war. On the other, it does seem like Zelensky thinks his hand will be strengthened if he has like some Russian territory to trade. It sounds like the talks are paused, but not off indefinitely. So I don't know. Maybe you could argue there's a net benefit down the road, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think that it's okay that they're delayed as someone who supports negotiation, because first of all, nothing is really going to happen before our election anyway. You know, so right. Like, there's no way that there's going to be an agreement in the next few months when Putin doesn't know whether it's going to be Kamala Harris who's going to continue to arm and equip the Ukrainians, or it's going to be Donald Trump who's going to withdraw that support on day one. So I think this is kind of all preliminary in any case. I also think clearly what's happening is the Russians are consolidating control with these gains of Donetsk and Luhansk, the regions that they are already in Ukraine. And so Zelensky is just trying to grab some territory to have some leverage to trade. And so the question is going to be, can he dig in and hold that territory? If he can, that's going to be a hugely important thing for him to know that he has going into the negotiation. Whereas if they're kind of pushed out of Russia quickly, then he has much less leverage to bring into that negotiation. So I definitely understand. The one thing that's interesting to me, Tommy, about the energy focus is the Russians control that giant nuclear power plant,
right,
Zaporizhzhia, and that is one of the huge power sources for Ukraine. And I imagine that that may be part of a negotiation too. Like, people think about territory, but Ukrainians probably want their nuclear power plant back. You know, it's not a small thing to lose.
No,
and that's kind of right on the front line. And so, that, you know, as they're thinking about rebuilding, they're also thinking not just about land, but they're probably thinking about things like that, because that's a very fast way to be able to restore a power source that they've lost. So all of these things are beginning to be aligned for, I think, next year, no matter who wins this election, next year is going to be very focused on negotiations. And so all these talks are kind of preliminary contacts, you know, first offers. But I think next year we're really going to be talking about brass tacks.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the wind will either be very much in Zelensky's face or somewhat at his back, depending on who wins this election.
Yes.
Another big story out of Thailand. So, Ben, it's clear that the plot by millennials to take over the world is proceeding apace, because if you look at Thailand, where a woman named Paetongtarn Shinawat has become prime minister at just 37 years old, she replaces Seta Tewisin, who was removed from office by the Constitutional Court for appointing someone to his cabinet who had been in jail. He's the fourth prime minister in 16 years to be removed by the court and was in office for less than a year. This Constitutional Court has been on quite an anti-democratic tear lately. A few weeks ago, it dissolved the Move Forward Party, which is the most popular political party in Thailand, that won the parliamentary elections but was prevented from forming a government by the Senate. Now they have helped install this 37-year-old prime minister who, oh, by the way, just happens to be the daughter of the billionaire founder of another political party. Here's a clip of her talking about her hopes for the job.
I decided that it's about time to do something for the country and for the party as well. And I hope that I can do my best to, you know, make the country go forward.
Quite a vision for the future there. She's actually the fourth member of her family to be prime minister at 37. Wow, who would have thought? Ben, what the hell's going on in Thailand?
All right, so I actually follow Thai politics a bit. And so first of all, what you have to remember is the military came to power in a coup about 10 years ago, actually when they ousted the sister. So the billionaire you mentioned is a guy named Thaksin, right?
Yep.
Thaksin is very popular populist leader, controlled a lot of media there. He was prime minister. He was ousted in 2006 in a coup. Then his sister, Yingluck, is ousted, I think, in 2014 in a coup.
2014, yeah.
Yeah. So the military has basically de facto controlled the government since. The beloved king died and his kind of strange playboy son ascended to the throne. And what's interesting to me is that the military in the kind of royalist elite there in Thailand is so desperate to cling to power that they've now turned to the populist party that they had multiple coups to get rid of to just find some base of support to keep the Move Forward party out. These people are good people in the Move Forward party. They're center left, they're progressives. They're kind of see themselves as connected to a broader democracy movement across Asia. Those are the good guys. So they're basically shunted to the sidelines. And now there's this deal between Thaksin and the military and the royal family and Thaksin's daughter, who was literally in the hotel business like a year ago. She was in like a hotel management business.
Sounds like a Trump.
She said like, you know, my passion is hotels, but I'm trying to do this for the good of the country. So let's try to give her the benefit of the doubt. Like, I hope she ends up being a good leader, is trying to do the right thing. But this is not democracy, right? And I think one of the things Americans forget is this is an ally of the United States. This is Thailand's a yeah. treaty ally of the United States. And we've tolerated a lot of shenanigans in their politics, mainly because the United States is worried that if we make too much noise about democracy, the Thai military will cozy up to the Chinese, you know? So it's the age-old story of us deprioritizing democracy. I frankly think that the Thai people, though, are on the side of democracy, that anytime they can express themselves, that's the message they send. They're on the side of a relationship with the United States. So I hope we can kind of keep nudging this back on the rails towards an actual election where the winning party in the election gets to govern, you know, a pretty core tenet there of democracy. But we'll see how long this arrangement lasts. Something tells me it's not going to be permanent.
Hey, fingers crossed. Well, best of luck to her. Okay, one final topic here. So for those of us who live in LA, you're no stranger to seeing the cyber trucks kind of cruising down the street. Those are the like car-like trucks sold by Tesla, brainchild of Elon Musk. People probably know I find Elon Musk to be incredibly annoying on Twitter. I find his politics very annoying. I find his personality repellent. But I try not to be a total hater because obviously like Tesla is an amazing company. SpaceX is an amazing company. But I will have to admit like, I think the Cybertrucks are like objectively hideous looking. They're just terrible looking cars.
Yeah.
There's always one parked at the Crooked Media office that someone painted like some horrible color of blue. And it's just like, I don't know, 90 grand just burned. But anyway, apparently hideous people also like to drive these trucks because Ramzan Kadyrov, the homicidal Putin stooge,
yes.
who is leading Russia's Chechen Republic, has one. He apparently tricked out his Cybertruck with some special features, including a machine gun, and posted about how much he loves it on Telegram. Kadyrov also claimed that Elon Musk sent him the Cybertruck, and he called Elon, quote, the strongest genius of our time and a great man. And then I think Kadyrov said he'd donate the truck to Russian troops fighting in Ukraine, which is kind of funny because when Elon rolled out the Cybertruck, he said it was indestructible, and then he threw a brick at the window to prove how indestructible it was, and the brick went right through the window. So I think the Ukrainian forces would be pretty okay with seeing the Cybertruck on the battlefield. Either way, Ben, if Elon really did give this truck to Kadyrov, that would be a problem for Elon because he's been sanctioned by the U.S. government for human rights violations, torture,
yeah.
and extrajudicial killings. Musk denied sending Kadyrov the vehicle, saying on Twitter, and I apologize for using this, but it's a verbatim quote of his tweet, quote, are you seriously so retarded that you think I donated a Cybertruck to a Russian general? That was what Elon said in response to these inquiries. And then he started complaining about legacy media lying about him when, as far as I can tell, this was a story that started on Telegram and then was spread on Twitter. So I don't know, Ben. Fake news here? What do you think? Elon's given this guy a truck? Think Kadyrov just bought it and said it came from Musk?
Well, so first of all, it is the biggest hunk of junk. Like I see those, my kids are 7 and 9 years old and they see those cars on the road in LA and they're like, ah, they're like, what is that? That's hard. Like it is just an eyesore.
They're terrible.
And it does tap into kind of the worst of LA, right? That you need to have this giant Tesla thing that looks like a car accident waiting to happen. Like, cause you just think you can ram things with it. Second point, Ramzan Kadyrov is perhaps the worst person in the world, you know?
He's on the list.
Yeah, no, he really is. If we were doing power rankings of like the 5 to 10 worst human beings alive in 2024, like he is very much on the list. He's a sadist. He's a sociopath. He's corrupt. He's had people killed. He's run assassination squads. You know, he was getting his picture taken in Ukraine early in the war. Now he's hanging out at his kind of like palatial villa in Chechnya where he, you know, presides over a system of repression. And so this is a terrible person. And
Nepo baby.
Yeah. Well, that leads us to the third point, which is if Elon Musk gave this guy this hunk of trash, that's a massive sanctions violation. Like someone might want to look into it if he's claiming it. I think just him being able to get that car at all is a sanctions violation of some sort. So like, you know, maybe try to figure out how that happened. But
I know,
you know, there seem to be some holes in the sanctions regime, like no matter how much we try to plug them and the holes are big enough to drive a truck through it, literally, I guess, you know. But I mean, there's between Elon Musk and David Sachs and the PayPal generals, like they are very Russia curious, you know? And so,
yeah,
because the Russians, you know, try to make contact with people that they think might be useful to them. So I do kind of wonder if you cast the net to include Elon and Sachs and all these guys, I do kind of wonder if they've been, you know, to use a spy terminology, if they've had a bump from Russian intelligence. I'm just kind of curious about that.
There was a weird report a couple of years ago that Elon and Putin had talked on the phone. And then shortly after, Elon started, it was from Ian Bremmer or somebody, I think, said it. And then shortly after, Elon kept saying these like very, basically the Russian talking points on what a Ukrainian, the history of Ukraine or a peace deal might look like. So that was quite weird. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of like kind of useful idiots that the Russian intelligence services might latch onto. Elon Musk, I'm not saying he's an asset in any way. I'm just saying like if you were to kind of rank people, American citizens that would be useful to them, Elon might be the most useful because Starlink is so critical to Ukrainian troops.
Yeah.
Because he's like delivering every satellite for the US military. He does intelligence stuff. He's got a security clearance. So yeah, I mean, I think if I was Russian intel guy, I'd be very interested in Elon.
Well, you know, he sent Tucker Carlson over there to film propaganda videos in the Moscow subway, remember? And the question that bears coming back to with Elon Musk is whether that much power should be concentrated in any individual's hands. Like Starlink, as we've seen, is like a nation state level amount of power that this guy has, never mind having a space program too, you know? So that's something we should probably consider, no matter what the politics of Elon Musk are, and politics happen to be pretty peculiar.
Pretty odd. Yeah, weird indeed. Two quick things before we get to Ben's interview. First, the whole reason the DNC is happening this week is because we got this really big election coming up. And Vote Save America is trying to meet the moment. They've set an ambitious goal to help ensure it's a success. They want to get to 75,000 volunteer signups in the next 25 days. We've got 40,000 already. We need to get 35,000 more. If you're not familiar with Vote Save America, it is the easiest way to get involved in politics right now and do so in a way that is tailored to you. It doesn't matter if you volunteered 1,000 times or never, they've got you covered and will help you find volunteer opportunities that work for you and have the biggest impact and will walk you through the process so it's fun and not scary and just, you know, a community of people who are all motivated and doing the right thing. So go to votesaveamerica.com/2024 to find opportunities near you and get involved. Again, that's votesaveamerica.com/2024. Also, if you need some motivation to help you get involved, get inspired, check out Stacey Abrams' new podcast, Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams. It is out now. Stacey's going to break down the most complex issues in American politics and help you understand how we got here, what the obstacles are, and what we can do to fix them. In her first episode, Stacey talks about the Electoral College process and how activists are working to change it by implementing ranked choice voting. If you want a podcast that helps you feel smarter and more motivated, this is it. Subscribe to Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then you'll hear Ben's interview. So stick around for that.
Hey,
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join. Shop your favorite brands and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS. The list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the app. That's Rakuten.
We are very pleased to welcome to Pod Save the World Alsu Kormasheva, a journalist for Radio Free Europe, who was recently released from Russia as part of the largest prisoner swap between the U.S. and Russia since the Cold War. Alsu was detained in 2023 when she was visiting her mother in Tatarstan, but was stopped at the border. That eventually led to both house arrest and prison, so quite an ordeal. But Alsu, we're really glad to be talking to you free from your home in Prague. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So, let me just start by asking, you know, how does it feel to be, you know, back home, back with your family after what I'm sure was an incredibly challenging period of time? I mean, we see these pictures of, you know, people getting off planes, but what is it like to kind of be re-entered into your life?
It feels wonderful. It feels overwhelming. I feel joy and I'm also exhausted, but, you know, positively exhausted from all the kindness and love I'm getting, all that kind of support from my family and friends here. But most importantly, my doors are open. I don't know, that was so important for me, that I can open my own doors and I can close them whenever I want. That's so important. So I'm catching up with my girls. We are listening a lot of Taylor Swift these days. We are watching movies I missed. We start our day with Taylor Swift and we end it because they sent me some lyrics, you know, from her new album, because I missed the release. And in my mind, I fantasized how that song might sound. And while I was reading those lyrics, and then when I came home in Prague, I listened to it. Like, it was, I know Taylor Swift, we've listened to it for years. So it's like, it was exactly how I imagined myself. You know, it's overwhelming. It's great. I have some issues to address, like medical issues. I'm returning to my life and it's great. It's been great. Thank you.
Your house sounds a bit like mine, actually. That album is played pretty much every day since it came out. Down Bad's a good track. On a more serious note, if you don't mind asking a couple questions about, you know, what the experience was like. The first question I wanted to ask is, when you were first detained, did you have any understanding of why? Like, what was that experience like of all of a sudden, you know, being denied your freedom? Did you see it as immediately political? Were you aware of kind of what the intention of the authorities were when you were first arrested?
My first arrest or detention at the airport in June 2023 was so surreal. I would never, ever think that something like that would happen in Kazan, Tatarstan. It's my native city. You know, I grew up there. I wasn't born there, but I grew up there. I went to school. People know me there. I joined the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty 25 years ago to moderate the Tatar language program. It's my native language. And I joined RFE because of the personal freedom and press freedom. You know, my language was oppressed during Soviet times when I was growing up. And that organization, American-funded organization, gave me that value of like speaking my language freely. And this is what I wanted my people to enjoy too. So like I was moderating the program and my voice was recognized. People know me in Kazan, and suddenly I'm arrested. I mean, it was so disheartening to see that. And I still believed it wasn't politically motivated. And when I was at home for 4 or 5 months before the arrest, I was really hoping that we can solve that peacefully, although I had a suspicion that I was targeted because I was an American journalist and that I was working for the Radio Free Europe. I had that suspicion, but I still believed that wasn't the case. But apparently it was.
And then you were, you know, you were under house arrest and then you were imprisoned. Do you have any sense from your lawyers as to kind of where you were in the legal process and why it seemed to escalate from kind of a home detention to an imprisonment? Was it clear or was it all kind of a black box to you?
It was black boxes. Still, I didn't understand where I might end up, where it will go to. But when I was arrested in October, we clearly knew that it was politically motivated. And the charges they brought against me were changing. If you remember, First I was charged with non-declaring my American citizenship. Second, they charged me with not declaring me being as a foreign agent. And then later they dropped those charges. The last one, the final one, was me spreading false fake information about the Russian army. So they were kind of building up the case, making up the case for the sham trial, for the show trial, I would say. And this is how it ended up. When I was arrested, it was clear it was political.
And did you have a sense at all that, you know, this might be because they were, you know, trying to use you in some future exchange? Or did it just seem like it was part of their crackdown on any kind of journalism or anybody with a dual citizenship? Your mind must have wandered in all kinds of directions. Did you have any guess at the motivation?
For months and months, the word or a hint of exchange didn't come. It hasn't come, and I didn't know. I'm just learning right now the scale of the campaign going on, which was going on to release me, to set me free. And it was unprecedented. It was unbelievable. Of course, I wasn't getting any information about that. I knew, even my lawyers didn't know everything. So from the limited information I was getting from Pavel, from my husband, through my lawyers, so I wasn't even allowed to talk on the phone, or visits to the prison were not allowed. I had a sense that something was going on, but more I believed that because I was wrongfully detained, you know, like no journalist should be detained anywhere in the world for doing their job. And that was my private trip to see my mom. It wasn't even like reporting trip. So I was hoping that justice will prevail and like people in Russia will realize that I was wrongfully detained and they will set me free, you know, like I was naive and something. And then later, months later, we started talking about a possible exchange, and I knew it could happen because I knew from books and movies that during the darkest times of the Cold War and, you know, the exchanges happened, the trades happened. So I knew it was possible, but it could have happened right after the sentence. It could have happened months after, and it could have happened years after, like it was with Paul Whelan, right? But I knew Evan Gershkovich's case was very, like he was a hero for me. When he was arrested in March 2023, it was such a shock for all journalistic community. And I was following his case, I was kind of looking what was happening to him and his trial. So when I realized that his trial and my trial were on the same day, I got a hope that something might be happening.
Interesting. I'm sure this is hard to kind of relive, but I'm sure people also are wondering what the conditions of your detention were like. You mentioned, obviously, the incredible freedom of just being able to open a door again. I mean, how were the conditions when you were imprisoned in Russia?
I was kept in isolation for 6 months, for first 6 months. I wasn't by myself. There was always one or two cellmates. The prison dates back to the 19th century, so the facilities are really old and bad. So in the first 6 months, I didn't have a bathroom. It was just a hole. And I didn't have hot water. And the winter, particularly last winter, was harsh. It was like minus 30, 35 Celsius, which is like almost close to Fahrenheit, right? So it was very cold. And I didn't have access to the library, but my friends and people I didn't know were sending me books. What kept me going those long winter, endless months was my thoughts about my family and my children. It's like number one. I was always, I drifted away every minute thinking what they're doing right now. And that helped me through that. We had TV. Occasionally we had a fridge. They were taken away. They were brought back. Nobody knows the reason, like why that was changing. Actually, the system is that the guards never talk to you about those things. They might talk to you about the letters I was getting. So there were lots of questions about the letters, why and who is writing them and how I know those people. But they would never talk about facilities and changing them. So the letters, my children, and you know, my faith, I always believed that God would never give more than people could handle. So like that's kind of my mantra and belief since I was very young, and I knew I would handle it. And the last 3 months, they changed my cell to a big one with 10 women. There was more social interaction there, slightly better facilities, though there was no window. There was like a very tiny window. It was in the basement, but there were lots of chats, you know, 10 women at once, lots of noise, chats about freedom, children. It was, some things were better in that bigger cell, but it was tiring. It was still a prison. It was still closed doors. We had 1 hour of a walk in a courtyard. The courtyard is also a small cell, but with a barbed wire above the heads. And it took me months and months before I could look up. Actually, it was so hard to look up to the sky through the barbed wire. But then I made an effort. I did it. And as I said, I drifted away with the clouds and with the wind and with the sun. I loved it.
Mm. That's very powerful. And were other people in for political offenses, or was it just women who were cycling through the prison system?
Among women, there were no inmates with political offenses. In that big cell where I spent 3 months, there were women charged with economic crimes, like corruption.
What was it like to get the news? Like, how did you learn that you were part of this exchange? And, you know, were you suddenly just being driven to some plane and that's it?
Yes. So my trial was rushed and I got my sentence of 6.5 years and 3 years ban of journalism. And by the Russian law, 15 days should pass until any kind of development after that, if I'm being taken somewhere to the camp, prison or anywhere. But within a week, Saturday morning, usually nothing happens on Saturdays and Sundays in prison. Saturday morning, the guard came and said, Alsu, out, you should be out in 15 minutes with all your personal belongings. We were shocked. I was scared. And the guard told the destination, which was opposite from Moscow. And the guard knew my case. And the guard knew that I can't possibly be changed. And he said, yes, you are being sent to that far destination where the prison camp is located. And, well, what can you do? You can't ask any questions. You just, you're in prison, you simply do whatever you are told to do. So I packed really quickly and I left. And, you know, nobody tells you where you're going. So I was put on that prison train. It's a special prison train with cages and it's detached to any train going to the certain destination, and it might go slowly and then stop at some point, and you might spend 24 hours somewhere and then like go continue your way. So I was given three ready-to-eat meals on that day, which means that my journey would take place 3 days. This is how you know how long the journey will be. And the train really took me to the far destination opposite from Moscow. Was I scared? Surprised? I don't know. Like, I had no emotions, because in prison, you spend hours and hours, days and days, and they're endless. You know, they were like, I spent so many days just sitting on the bench in the cell because we were not allowed to do anything. We were either waiting for an inspection to inspect our cell, or nothing was going on. So I was lucky if I had a book. I had a book with me. So I was just praying, meditating, and like thinking about nothing. At the end of the second day, the inmates, other inmates changed in the prison car, in the prison train, and suddenly they were all going to Moscow. So we talked to each other and they asked me why I was going to Moscow. And I said, I have no idea. And so they were all men. I was the only woman there. Again, nobody told me where I was going. And they brought me to Moscow. They brought me to Moscow and they never said which prison I was going to. They took all my personal belongings. I was brought there on Monday and they said that I will get everything on Friday. And I asked them what will happen on Friday. And they didn't say anything. So they left. I was changed to the prison robe and I was given paper and a pen. And I had two books to read and they gave me meals. That's it. So this is how I spent almost a week in Moscow. And one morning, actually not Friday, but Thursday, it was August 1st, the guard came with my personal belongings and clothes. And he said, you change now and you'll be out in 15 minutes. And you know the rest probably.
Yeah. Well, did you, in the kind of re-entry, did you have any opportunity to interact with Evan Gershkovitz or Paul Whelan, the other people involved in the exchange?
Not until we were on a plane from Ankara to the United States. Okay. I saw them on the bus. We greeted each other, but we were not allowed to talk. And to tell the truth, everything was so shocking. We didn't even know what to talk about at the first moment. We had no idea. We all knew this was so wonderful and great and scary at the same time. Only on the plane we started talking slowly, only on the plane to the United States.
And I imagine obviously overwhelming joy at being reunited with your family, your children. Also just an incredibly extreme experience. I mean, does the US government help provide any support as you're kind of reintegrating, or is it you land in the States, you see the President of the United States, and then you're back to Prague? I mean, how has the re-entry been?
Well, you know what I want to say, again, and I learned this only when I was free, the support and the campaign, which was around my release, was possible only by such a great effort and by the U.S. government's rights groups, and especially both Republican and Democratic members of Congress. And the effort was bipartisan, which like really made me happy, because everybody united in that campaign to reunite me with the family. And that's what I always believed in, the American set of values, you know. And just my daughter, Bibi, called me a connector in one of the interviews, probably was in Bloomberg or somewhere. And like me and my case connected people. And it was like, it was great to know, really. And I really want to personally thank on this podcast, special gratitude to Chairman Michael McCall, Chairman Ben Cardin, Representatives Jason Crow, Representative Bill Keating, Representative Brian Mass, Senator Chris Van Hollen, many, many others, and the Foley Foundation, the Wall Street Journal. The list is long, and I really hope one day I can hug everyone who really helped me and helped me to reunite with my family and be free. So I spent almost a week, I think, in the United States with my family. And before coming back to Prague, I got medical assessment, I got counseling, and it was great. It was just great. And mostly I was with my family just resting and catching up and reflecting on what has happening.
Well, you know, RFEs is such a great outlet. I've enjoyed doing some things with them, including the Russian language service over the years. I know it's early days, but do you feel like you'll get back to the work of journalism? How are you looking at the future?
I'm still unpacking what has happened, really.
Yeah, I bet.
It will take some time for sure. And I'm not planning anything right now. You know, I really don't know. I really don't know what I will do next, but definitely what I want to do, I'm doing right now. I'm thinking about three of my colleagues at RFE who have been held in Russian and Belarus prisons right now in Russia-occupied Crimea and Belarus. And actually, this week, I believe one of them, Andrei Kuznetsov, the Belarus journalist who worked for the Belarus service, marks 1,000 days in prison. And I'm thinking about their families, and I really want to help them reunite. I don't know how I will do that, but I will keep them in my thoughts and prayers. And if my experience can help them and their loved ones, I will be really happy to join the effort with those who are helping them. That's my thought. That's my idea. I haven't started anything yet, but after I take some rest, I want to do that. You know, my passion is education. I might go back to educate the new generation of journalists. Why not? The new generation is really, they're great. They share love and compassion, and they're very educated. Maybe not educate them, but learn from them. We'll see. I really don't know. I'm thinking about very simple things really right now, like enjoying my eggs for breakfast that I didn't have for 10 months. You know, I didn't even know that would be so important for me.
Well, you're reminding us what is important. And one of the lessons we should all take from this is that people should make their voices heard. They should make it clear that those who are detained wrongfully are not forgotten, and that there are people that care about them and are working for their release back home, including your RFE colleagues. There's one other really important matter. Jake Sullivan was on this podcast a couple weeks ago and mentioned that...
I watched that.
I'm sure your daughter was happy to see you. Of course, she didn't get to go to the Taylor Swift concert in Warsaw. So we're sending the message out to anybody who can get tickets that there's a family that would very much like to see Taylor in concert, right?
Taylor Swift and her concerts this year was the biggest hope for my children to get me back. So every morning and night, apparently, when I was in prison, my daughters talked about two things: reunite with their mom and see Taylor Swift at the concert. So they had tickets to a Warsaw show on August 2nd. And I was released August 1st. So we got reunited. That dream came true. So one dream at a time. And so we are waiting for the second dream to come true. I really believe we can make it this year. So I hope so. But you're so right. No journalist should be detained. Every journalist detained should be designated as wrongfully detained. No journalist should be prosecuted for their job. This is the basic value of a free world.
Yeah, no, and I mean, it's just a terribly troubling increase in journalists being detained, both in Russia and other places around the world. I really want to thank you for sharing your story, for your commitment, obviously, to see that other people are freed. It's really just a wonderful and all too rare piece of good news to have you back with your family in Prague. So thanks so much for joining us. And we really wish you the best. And we'll encourage everybody to continue to keep the spotlight on those people that remain wrongfully detained around the world.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks again to all of you for joining the show, and talk to you guys next week.
If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. If you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Ilona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick and engineered by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Phoebe Bradford, William Jones, Kirill Palaviv, and Molly Lobel, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld. If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.